Hello, nerds, and welcome to the Engadget podcast. This is episode 26, The Sounds of Science. I am your host, Terrence O'Brien. I am back again this week. It's been kind of a rough few weeks for me. I keep getting sick and disappearing from the face of the earth for a while, but I'm back. I'm feeling better. Kind of, sort of.
Good.
Joining me this week, managing editor Dana Wollman.
Hello. It's also been a rough few weeks for me. I am also somewhat better. I have this just in case.
Yeah, you've been in and out and sick and back and forth.
Stifling coughs all over the place, yeah.
Basically, the whole Engadget staff is dying.
Just don't go to CES.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Also joining me this week is Nate Ingram, who is not dying too high.
Not at the moment.
That's because you fell ill at CES.
I was sick for the first 2 weeks of the year, but I think that's all behind me now. And unless I get it from sitting here with you guys, which is a distinct possibility.
Entirely possible. Yeah. This is also your first time back here in a while.
Last time I was here was the day after Trump's election, and now we're here the week after his inauguration. So it seems like I always draw the short straw on podcast duties. RAP all of our mentions today because it's going
to
get ugly.
Yeah, I mean, basically we only have you on to talk Trump.
That's not true.
I know nothing about technology, guys. It's all a farce.
And for those of you who want to know and maybe want to tune out,
trigger warning,
we're going to be talking Trump later, Trump and science. So if you don't want to listen to it, there's plenty of other podcasts out there, but actually please stay around and listen. It's going to be a good conversation.
I prefer if you tell people to not tune out.
Yeah. Perhaps a bad move on my part. We love you all. We want you to listen. I feel a little rough, but we're going to jump right into it.
Let's get into it.
I'm a little shaky out of practice here. Let's start this show, as we do most weeks, with Flame Wars.
Yes.
This is where we debate the biggest topics and stories of the weeks. Once again, my brain is not working.
All the weeks.
As I usually warn everybody, this is purely an intellectual exercise.
Oh, yes.
Nobody actually believes the things they're saying necessarily on here.
I believe some of them.
Some of them. Everybody will get 20 seconds to make their opening statement, at which point I'll allow a brief rebuttal and then award a point to the winner. I need to get my timer set up because I failed to do that beforehand because I am the worst.
You can't count this off in your head?
No, I have my shoes on. It would be really difficult for me to count to 20.
All right.
So why don't we start?
Let's start
with Sprint. Yay. And Tidal.
Oh, yeah.
A thing that I can see Dana is clearly very excited to talk about.
I mean, I'm going to win this one. But
yeah.
Okay.
So for those of you who don't know, earlier this week, Sprint purchased a 30 or 33% stake in
Tidal. A third, they said. Yeah.
A third, yeah.
Stake in Tidal, which is the streaming music service owned by Jay-Z and a host of other artists that literally nobody cares about except for the fact that it got the timed exclusive rights to Life of Pablo when it came out. Otherwise,
I think Lemonade also. They got Lemonade first.
Oh, I think you are right about that. So really sort of big picture question here, though, is, you know, what does Sprint have to gain by making this purchase? Is this a big mistake for Sprint in buying Tidal? Dana, you get to go first.
Not much to gain right now. Even if Sprint were to get some exclusives, some Tidal exclusives for its subscribers, this would not move the needle and push Sprint past its position as the fourth ranking carrier in the U.S. And I don't think Tidal would give its best exclusives just to Sprint if that is the size of Sprint's audience.
I have a hard time disagreeing with those statements. However, before I start, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Can you pull up what the purchase price was?
Sure. Let me see if we have that. I'm actually not entirely sure that's been announced, but let me double check.
According to 200.
According to sources, the deal is worth $200 million, but it's not been confirmed as of the last time we saw.
That's good enough, though. All right. Now I am ready. Thank you.
Doing your research for you here
live on the air.
All right. Your 20 seconds begins now, sir.
I think that for Sprint, it at least gives them something to offer their subscribers, hopefully some like discounts on it. Maybe that's not a bad thing if you're on Sprint. And I think that also it maybe isn't the smartest move, but at the price of $200 million, I think that's a relatively small drop in the bucket in terms of how much money Sprint is working with here. So they don't have a lot to lose. Maybe not a lot to gain, but not a lot to lose.
So Dana, my question to you is, seeing as how a lot of these services are kind of, we're seeing this condensing of the media market, and I keep banging the table with my watch. You know, AT&T has DirecTV and they're offering streaming. This is, you know, a service on top of the actual, like, data. Sprint doesn't have that equivalent. Does it not make sense for them to try and at least pick up something in the media sphere, even if it's this, like, sort of third-tier music streaming service as a way of offering their customers something beyond, like, a nice data package?
I mean, perhaps, but even here, right, you could still be a Tidal subscriber and subscribe to a different network. Tidal, for its part, is looking for all the new subscribers.
They don't care what network they're on, yeah.
Right. I think sort of to Nate's point, I think what Sprint could get out of this is a perception of hipness, perhaps. I mean, especially wrestling with T-Mobile as the third-ranking carrier in the U.S., T-Mobile's ads are attention-getting. Its CEO, John Legere, is attention-getting. They seem adversarial and rebellious and cool. This is all subjective, right?
That's really the image that they're going for.
Sprint is none of those things.
I might take issue with the cool part of that equation, but adversarial and rebellious for sure.
Well, and Sprint's best marketing tactic so far has been bringing back the Verizon guy. Like, that's some pretty weak sauce. So I think having Tidal in their pocket is a lot better than, you know, saying, hey, we've got the can you hear me now guy.
Right. I mean, right now, Sprint is last ranking. That's a fact. We can't dispute. But I think it also falls on the stodgy end of the spectrum. Really no hipper than Verizon or AT&T.
Did Sprint lose all of their, like, hipness and street cred with the death of Nextel and the chirp? Was that, like, kind of it?
I don't think they ever really had much to begin with.
Yeah.
Right? Sorry. Okay, Nextel, but, like, yeah, there were separate brands when Nextel was cool.
Is it Sprint right now whose advertising campaigns basically amount to our network coverage is almost as good as Verizon's?
Yes, that is correct. Like, we're 98% of Verizon.
We're, like, 1% off Verizon, right, or something. That's the best they can do right now in terms of advertising. So if a Tidal partnership, and I guess I'm arguing your side now, but not really.
I know we should have switched, apparently, because you're making some decent points.
No, I mean, I stand by my other points, but if that's currently the best they can do in terms of reaching people and convincing people to join Sprint, saying our network is technically worse than Verizon's, but not that much worse, maybe this gives them something else.
The thing I was just thinking, too, is it's gone. I can't even argue my own point. That's terrible. Oh, so with the new FCC commissioner, with net neutrality under fire, it's entirely possible that Sprint will start offering Tidal as it won't count against your data usage.
Well, but
you know, as crappy as that is for net neutrality, I could see how some customers might appreciate it.
But carriers already can do that, at least on the wireless side. I mean, T-Mobile does that, right?
True.
But
they have to negotiate these deals with the various services, I'm sure. But
yeah.
All right. Well, how do you want to rule this one?
I mean, it goes to Dana. Sorry.
That's fine. I went into this knowing I was going to be down a point. Now I just got to step it up a little.
But I fought for you too.
You did well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was kind of works in Dana's favor, because regardless of which way I felt, Dana won.
Yeah. No, she had
made
all
the better arguments for both sides.
And I was even trying to do research on the air. Didn't help.
So let's move on to our second story, which is Samsung. The Note 7 saga finally seems like it came to an end this past week.
I'd say so.
Hopefully so.
I mean,
God knows there might be a few of them still floating out there somewhere waiting to
explode. I think we're mostly done talking about the Note 7.
Yeah.
After this podcast.
Which, you know, kind of brings me to the question here, which is, you know, is Samsung's apology for the Note 7 debacle enough, and has it finally actually put this whole, like, battery gate thing behind it? Nate, we are going to start with you.
I'm going to say that they did a good job of the apology, a good job explaining what happened. But the next time there is a phone, all everyone's going to do is write about how, oh, maybe it's going to blow up. Like, I think that it's going to really just be this talking point for people for at least another year, and that's going to just make it harder, I think, to convince people to buy it.
Dana?
I don't actually disagree with what Nate said about the fact that people will, that Samsung has some work to do in restoring trust. But its apology this past week was at least thorough and humble.
Things that often cannot be said for Samsung. The humble part, anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, to be fair, the humble part is something that can't be said of most companies, true, right? Mm-hmm. Do you give them any sort of credit for that? And do you think that that does anything for them with consumers? If you put that up against, say, Apple, when, there was AntennaGate, Apple was anything but humble, did not apologize, and essentially blamed their customers for problems with their own phone.
The only thing I'll say is that we're talking about, slightly decreased performance versus phones that are literally exploding. So I think Samsung had no choice but to be as, direct and humble as possible in this situation. There was no room for any sort of spin or playing with, how they presented that stuff.
Which,
to their credit,
most,
they did that.
Right. And I appreciated not just the explanation. And to recap the facts, their explanation included not one but two different battery problems. There was one specific to the original batch of phones and then a different problem entirely relating to the replacement phones that were supposed to be
because they rushed
safe.
It.
Yeah. And now it seems that they're reorganizing their operations somewhat to include a special team that does final crucial checks on these components. And on the one hand, you would have expected or hoped that companies had something in place like that to begin with,
yep.
But they do now, yeah. At least.
So here's my question to you, Dana, which is, they have some sort of quality control. I mean, every company does, mm-hmm. And it clearly failed multiple times, and multiple vendors failed in providing Samsung with these parts. Samsung, like most electronics companies, doesn't make everything that goes into their phones or their laptops themselves. Was this kind of enough to allay people's concerns, do you think? Is there going to be lingering issues with wondering whether or not their quality assurance is up to snuff and wondering whether or not their new, the new component makers are going to be able to create batteries and whatever else safely and, all of these things?
I think it remains to be seen somewhat. It was interesting that a few days after this press conference, Samsung released its most recent quarterly earnings, and they actually looked pretty good. I think it was something like the biggest profit Samsung had seen in 3 years or something like that.
I knew it was good. I know it was that good.
But a lot of that money actually came from the sale of components to other companies, and this was going on. I'm sure these orders were placed maybe
way in advance.
Right. I mean, possibly before this whole Note 7 thing unfolded. So I think it remains to be seen both how Samsung's mobile division does and how even its own component division does.
I think we're going to see just how long of a memory do consumers have versus, the fact is the Galaxy S7 was probably the best phone Samsung's ever made. The Note 7 was looking like it could be until this happened. Will people remember?
I think too. I think one of the problems here, the battery life on the Note 7 was almost too good to be true. And
it was too good to be true.
It was. And I mean, that's what happens when you try something like squeezing a too big battery into too small of a casing. Yeah. And if anything, I wouldn't be surprised if Samsung erred next time on the side of safe.
Mm-hmm.
A phone that doesn't blow up but maybe isn't groundbreaking or exciting.
Yeah.
That's most phones, though, right?
It's a lot of phones.
It is, in fact.
Like 99% of phones are not groundbreaking or exciting, but
also
don't explode.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, LG is rumored to be making its next phone less weird for totally different reasons besides
because when they make weird phones, nobody
buys
them.
Yeah. Right.
I'm going to give this one to Nate, I think.
That was a pity vote right there.
No, it's not. Here's what I'm going to say. Right. I think while I appreciate their apology, and I think they went further in their apology and their investigation than a lot of companies would, and I give Samsung a lot of credit for that. I think ultimately consumers' memory is a lot longer than this. I don't think going out apologizing is going to end this story.
It's such an easy thing for people to call back to. Oh, it's the phone that blows up. Yeah. There's no way. It can take a long time to erase that sort of tagline from people's memories.
Yeah, I think it's at this point, it's very much a lot of wait and see. And so it's hard to say that it's finally kind of put this whole thing behind it. And just sort of an anecdote to the side of that is somebody coworker of my wife was recently in the market for a new phone and was always an Android user and ended up buying an iPhone because, and this is an issue with all Android phones, it's like a sort of an industry-wide problem, is she just associates all of them. They're all Droid phones to her. And so she thought that all Android phones exploded. And I'm wondering how widespread that is, because I do know that a lot of people just like all Android phones are Droid phones, quote unquote, in their heads. Like they're all the same.
Well, that is one way in which Engadget readers are different from the general public.
Yes. Good on you guys.
Yeah.
But like, also remember our readership makes up a very small portion of the population in the grand scheme of things. So I think we'll have to wait.
Dana face.
Yep. Let's move on to our last story Flame Wars. And this one is going to go back to probably something you guys haven't heard of in a while, and that's Google Voice.
Yeah.
Still a thing.
That is still a thing.
And you guys thought we were going to talk about Trump this whole time.
Yeah, we're giving you a full spectrum of nerdy topics. Yeah,
we're going to start with this. So let's just let's just go straight for it, and Dana, we'll start with you. You can answer this one first, which is, you know, did Google let voice stagnate for way too long, and should it might as well be dead?
Oh, that's not the question I thought we were going to be answering today.
All right, hang on.
Whoa.
That is what it says here in the script is, has Google let voice stagnate for too long? Is the service as good as dead?
You are a sneaky blockhead, but okay, I'll answer the question.
Do you want me to go first?
Let's go with Nate first, because you're going to argue that it is, in fact, dead.
Wait, me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
So I'm going to start your 20 seconds now. Tell me why Google Voice is dead. Dana, you start forming your rebuttal.
Google Voice is dead because Google's communications and messaging services are all so confused and intertangled at this point that I don't know how refreshing one that they haven't touched in 2 or 3 years is going to make anything any better. They've got Allo, they've got Hangouts, now Voice is back. It's such a mess that I don't see how Voice can stand out at all.
Dana, you now have to figure out a way.
Yeah,
to...
so I can't answer the question of should it be dead, or I'm not answering that question. But it's clearly not dead. At Google just invested all of this developer energy into updating the design language, but also is clearly explicitly promising new features like better voicemail transcription. It's actually pretty rare for companies to talk explicitly about what's on their product roadmap. So it's not dead, even if you think it should be.
I'll agree that it's not dead. I was surprised to see it come back to life here. But I think the problem is, what compelling reason does someone who's never used Google Voice before have to try it now? I'm sure that there are lots of people who use it and are happy to see it get updated. But at this point, I can't think. I mean, like, you can do messaging in it now, which is great, I suppose. You've always been able to send text messages, but they added photo capabilities. They're trying to make it compatible with the next generation SMS, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, why would I use that over Hangouts or over Allo or over Duo or just making a phone call? Like, it's just they need to simplify their products there and make it clear what the value
proposition is.
What's
the support of these products across Chromebooks, which I know you love?
Ooh.
So you know Skype doesn't really work well still on
Chromebooks. Yeah, no. So you can do calls through Hangouts on Chromebooks, and I'm pretty sure if you go to the Google Voice homepage, you can also make calls like just through the browser, regardless of what platform it's on.
So even then, on a Chromebook, voice
wouldn't
be
that. I'm not actually sure of. I'm going to look at that right now while we continue talking. I believe you can make what amount to Google Voice calls
on voice
from Hangouts, but I don't know that you can actually make them from the.
If you go to voice.google.com,
that's what I'm looking at right now.
Looks like you've got the updated UI. Do you use Google Voice?
I do.
Oh, all right.
I am an avid Google Voice user and have been since it was called Grand Central, so this is like a thing close, near and dear to my
heart. Well, I'd love to hear your take on this then as well.
It does not look like you can make calls, by the way, from the web.
That is what happens when you click the phone icon there.
You can send a text message.
Yep.
But the phone icon is just sending messages. It's just like a list of incoming and outgoing calls.
You see,
right now what you're doing is you're arguing my side because this makes no sense.
I have a bigger complaint there that's a missed opportunity for both the Google Voice team and the Skype team, which I think has been very slow on that count.
I mean,
You're right. I think you're right about you can do it through Hangouts.
Yeah, you can definitely
dial
do it
a number
through
there, right? Yeah.
So Dana, you know, you were saying that they've put all of this developer effort into it. My question kind of there is, how much effort are they actually putting into it? I mean, because doing the UI overhaul honestly isn't necessarily that big of an investment in time and effort. A lot of this stuff
it's worthwhile, for sure.
It's worthwhile, but a lot of this stuff is, like, pre-built. Because it's, you know, Google has a set of, like, UI building
themes.
Tools and themes and all that stuff. Like, a lot of the stuff is, like, just pre-designed buttons that they're throwing into a place in an interface that honestly isn't that different from the one they had before. It just has the new icons. and the better voicemail transcription stuff isn't necessarily voice specific. It's just like Google's voice recognition technology has gotten better, and plugging that into their voicemail thing seems kind of like a no-brainer.
It was them going on record about the upcoming features that
kind of did it for you.
That did it for me.
They did say that this was not just like the one-time facelift. Like they were gonna, we should see other things happening with voice this year. Which,
and
again,
I say that even from my experience at Engadget. Engadget itself has a team of developers who are creating things to benefit you guys, the viewers and readers and listeners, but would probably not go on record talking about what they have coming unless they were...
really, truly invested.
There were zero chance they'd flake on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That said, Google does have a bit of a history of trying stuff out, canceling it, trying again. They're a lot more publicly experimental than most companies, I would say.
Yeah, for sure. Often to their detriment, perhaps. I'm going to give this one to Dana.
Are you kidding me? That's because you love Google Voice.
It's because you're rusty. You should come on more frequently than every three months.
Well, even when I was coming on more, I was getting spanked, so I don't know if that's going to help.
I do love Google Voice, though.
Can you tell me why you? I'd love to hear, A, why you like it, and B, why you sided with Dana.
So, A, why I like it is it's my work phone number. Mm-hmm. So... I don't have, like, a desk phone at the office. I don't want to have to carry a second phone that's specifically for Engadget. And I don't want to hand out my personal cell phone number to people. So I have a work number. And that's, I mean, I've had it for a long time besides for work, but I use it for Engadget, and I don't answer it. it is specifically, basically, just, like, a voicemail service for, like, PR people. It's also the number I give out when, like, I sign up for things because it's easy to, like, block spam and stuff, so I don't have to worry about people calling me at all hours of the night, like, to sell me shit. The other thing is that it's because of that I feel safe giving that number out. So, like, I recently set up Signal so that we could so that I could, like, accept, like, tips and stuff securely and leaks and whatever, which, by the way, if anybody out there... and we'll talk about this more later. If anybody wants to send Engadget tips and leaks or specifically send that stuff to me, I'm on Signal. You can find my Google Voice number, which is associated with my Signal account, and you can send them to me securely. But that's like a thing. Like, I have no issue putting my Google Voice number on my Twitter page, like, because...
You can just shut it off if you don't want it.
Yeah, I have no issue with it.
All right, you're convincing me.
My world would be kind of ruined if Google Voice went down, because a lot of people have that number.
I've had very little... I've never really minded handing out my personal number, to be honest, so I guess that's the difference. I just don't pick up calls that I don't recognize if I don't want to.
Here's the thing is I've had, like, my home phone number. Like, I still have, like, a landline, which is probably weird for people, for so long that, like, so many companies have that number that I just straight up don't answer the phone anymore. I might as... It's I only use it to, like, make conference calls for work. That's all the only purpose it serves.
Nice.
But yeah.
All right.
Point goes to Dana. Let's move on.
Yay.
Let's move on.
Let's move on to group chat. This is where we talk about the biggest issues of the week, the biggest story of the week.
The bigliest.
And guys, it's the first week of the Trump's presidency.
No way around it.
There's no way around this being the biggest story of the week.
Yes.
He is getting to work, starting to make decisions about science and tech policy that you may or may not agree with.
Yep.
Among many, many other troubling things.
And I mean, I don't think I'm out of line by speaking for all of us when I say we all disagree with it.
Yeah.
very much. So I think the interesting thing here is that he's not making a ton of, like, really serious policy decisions yet. Mostly what he's doing, it seems like, is trying to rein in a lot of these research organizations and stuff.
That's on the science side. We'll talk, too, about his FCC appointment, which I think does amount to policy decisions.
So why don't we actually start with the FCC thing, Dana? Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I mean, basically, his FCC appointee is a known opponent of net neutrality. So basically, to appoint him is tantamount to making policy decisions. Doesn't mean any laws or policies have changed yet, but it's a pretty clear sign of where we're headed.
Yeah, I believe that in December he co-authored a paper for the FCC detailing why he does not believe in net neutrality and why the agency is, in a blanket statement here, going to be going more friendly to companies. And the byproduct of that is that they will be less friendly to consumers in all likelihood, I would say.
And to be clear, too, when he was appointed this week, basically every telecom issued a press release.
We should name this person, by the way.
Yes.
It is. I'm probably going to screw up his name, and I feel really bad, and I apologize for that. But is it Ajit Pai?
Yep.
I believe, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, and I apologize if I'm not. I'm the worst at pronouncing things in general.
He's been at the FCC for a good 4 years already. He was appointed under Obama as a Republican commissioner, you know, to balance things out there. But yeah, he's always been pretty clear.
And every
about
telecom
it.
Cheered his appointment.
Yes.
This week,
which
says a lot.
To be fair, most telecoms also cheered the appointment of Tom Wheeler.
Yeah.
I mean, he was very much an industry insider. Mm-hmm. He was very much a friend of the telecommunication industry. He worked in the telecommunications industry. He was not, like, a consumer advocate in a previous life.
And even if he was, they probably would have just sent some sort of milquetoast PR saying, you know, blah, blah, blah.
And Tom Wheeler's legacy in net neutrality is, I think, fair to say mixed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think early on he was definitely hesitant to push as hard on net neutrality as, you know, we probably think he should have. And, I mean, even by the end, when we got some really, like, solid rules around, like, Title II and the regulation of the internet and stuff like that, there's still, like, a lot of pretty big loopholes.
Lots of gray area, I feel
especially like. Especially on the wireless end, which is why we have things like...
Binge on.
Yeah.
Right?
So, you know, it's... I don't know. It's sort of a weird thing, because I don't want to judge him too harshly, because I think... Tom Wheeler surprised a lot of us mm-hmm. who were paying attention. He surprised mm-hmm. me, I know. When he was named, I went, well, there's no chance in hell we're getting net neutrality now. Like, that's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And especially after the first plan came out, and I think it was very underwhelming for a lot of people who were proponents of net neutrality.
But they seem to take the criticism to heart and improve it, I would say.
So now the question is... Does the Trump administration and the new FCC chairman take that sort of criticism and the public desire for net neutrality to heart?
I would go with no, because Trump is so clearly pro-business that I think that's just going to be the default position and anything contrary to that.
That's what I would have said. I don't think he is specifically that strongly anti-net neutrality. I don't think it's a pet issue of his, but I think he is indeed pro-business.
He is pro-business. I mean, he's... Donald Trump has spoken very little about net neutrality mm-hmm. in general. What little he has said about net neutrality, I will say, you know, shows that he doesn't understand the issue. And I'm not saying that to be, like, flippant or dismissive of him. I mean, you know, I'm clearly not a fan of his in general, but this is his statements about net neutrality reflect minimal understanding of the issue. He's compared it to the fairness doctrine, and the two things are in no way related whatsoever. So it's kind of hard to pinpoint where he's at personally on it, if only because while he's been very openly against, he also hasn't really clearly stated why, at least in any sort of reasonable terms. So we kind of have to go on.
Well, what I imagine is that the FCC will just kind of push the rulings forward, and he'll probably just go with them. Because I don't think he's going to care enough to invest any attention in the issue.
Probably not. You know, I get the feeling that what you're looking at is an undoing of net neutrality, just because I think it's the sort of thing where Trump feels like it's an easy point to score with the Republican establishment,
mm-hmm.
who tend to be very pro-business.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably getting a little bit off topic, yeah. and so I'll avoid going too far down this rabbit hole. But I think if you look at Trump as a candidate and as a president, he holds a lot of beliefs and is pushing a lot of policies that are kind of anathema to traditional Republican values. And so he kind of has to, like, you know,
slide a few things.
Yeah,
in
he's got to, like, throw a couple of bones their way and be like, you know, you don't want net neutrality. That's fine. We don't have to have net neutrality. But I want big infrastructure spending, like, and stuff like that. And so he's going to kind of figure out ways to wheel and deal.
Yeah. And this seems like an easy card to play.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't care about it. So just, you know, do what will make him happy.
Any other thoughts on that, Dana?
No, I basically agree. I mean, I'm willing to be surprised, but expect him to err on the side of fewer regulations.
Yeah.
The good news is that I think it'll take some time, at the very least. And I think this kind of goes back to, like, what has happened this week. There's been a lot of, like, laying groundwork for stuff to change, but I think not a lot has actually changed, which is at least somewhat heartening, right? Eventually, you know, he can issue all these executive orders and appoint people, but at some point, it's going to get down to dealing with the rest of the government, and that's when things will slow down. And this, I think, changing net neutrality is one of the things that will at least take a little bit of work to, you know, get done.
Yeah. So the other big storyline this week, in his first week, has been this sort of stuff about, like, gag orders put on certain agencies or departments of the agencies, in particular the EPA.
National Park.
The National Park Service, the USDA, but not the entire USDA. It was specifically the Agricultural Research mm-hmm. Service, I believe.
Yeah.
And certain sub-departments in the Health and Human Services, right? Am I correct on all these things?
I don't know about the last one.
That doesn't ring as familiar.
Hang on, let me double-check this.
But the overarching theme seems to definitely be an attack on science-related parts of the government. That's how I would categorize it anyway.
Okay, so
what do you got?
I was going to say, talk a little bit about that. Like, lay out that argument for me.
Well, so Trump has been very anti-EPA for a while. Now, he said he wants to do some major reform in the EPA. So he started off the presidency by putting a freeze on grants and contracts. And while that's not totally unprecedented, I think it was a little more of an aggressive move than has been made in the past usually. You know, every time a new administration comes along, they want to kind of put the brakes on things and figure out what work is being done before they move forward with it. But going along with that has been like a gag order on the EPA and the other agencies you mentioned, that, like, no press releases, no social media. And that's kind of troubling because these are government agencies that our tax dollars are paying for who are being told not to communicate with the public. So that is a problem. And the fact that it's very specifically science-related, climate change-related, is troubling. They're basically saying, we don't want you guys putting out this propaganda about climate change being a thing because we want to destroy the environment with our pro-business plans. Basically, I mean, that's what on the Trump's website, or on the White House website this week, as the transition happened, they removed all the pages relating to climate change, which, again, I think people are overstating the impact of that. You know, it's a totally new website. Some things are not making the transition to the new site. But if they cared about climate change, they would have a page about it. They do not. That sends a message. All this stuff is sending messages about what's important in this.
And all this website stuff, I don't think, in general, by the way, I don't think are accidents. I also don't think it's an accident that the Spanish language option was removed from the website. That was also symbolic and meaningful.
Yes, it's all very much like you can look at all these actions happening and say this shows what the priority is, even if it's not necessarily enacting a new policy yet, right? That's how I would categorize it.
So, I mean, I think there is certain stuff about this that is troubling, but I've been thinking a lot about this the last couple of days, and I the hopeful part of me, like the optimistic part of me, has like, and yeah.
Wait, really, there is an optimistic
there
part
is.
Of you?
Okay. There has come to the idea that there's two ways of looking at this that suggest that it's not necessarily as malicious as
it might seem.
So one of these, I think, one of these ways of looking at it, I think, is part of what you were saying before, is that, you know, like, not everything's going to make the transition. I think this is the first transition of power from president to president in, like, the truly digital age.
That's true.
And it's been very messy on all levels.
Yeah.
You know, they couldn't even get the Twitter account handover for at POTUS right at first.
So I'm going to say, actually, that I'm surprised they got it done as well as they did, to be perfectly honest. The fact that they were able to take everything that was on POTUS and transfer it to a new account, the fact that that worked seamlessly at noon that day, I mean, the fact that the transferring of that content worked was pretty surprising to me. The follower stuff, I can almost see why that was weird. But anyway, I'm just throwing out a word of support for Twitter there. I think they did a decent job.
No, I mean, it wasn't a complete debacle, but it was also not super smooth.
True.
And I think, you know, you're going to see a lot of issues like that. You're going to see these sort of, like, bits and pieces that aren't working the way they should.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also abundantly clear that Trump and his transition team are not stocked up the way they should be. I'd have to go double check what the number is on this. But if you go, I'm a big fan of the Weeds Vox podcast, which is all about, like, policy and stuff. And they were talking about
the name of the podcast is The Weeds.
It's called The Weeds.
Nice.
I suggest people listen to it. It's a very good show. And they kind of get into, like, the nitty gritty of policy and running the government and stuff. And they were speaking about sort of the way the transition has been handled so far, and basically the number of, like, appointees, presidential appointees that you're supposed to have running in is somewhere around the range. Like, there's, like,
some thousands, right?
Not or thousands, but there's hundreds of positions that need to be filled by presidential appointment. And generally, by the time the inauguration comes around, most of those people are named and, like, ready to go, even if they have to go through confirmation. Like, stuff is laid the groundwork, and the Trump transition team has, like, less than half of what the other administrations have had coming in.
So they're operating at a deficit.
They're operating at a deficit.
In terms of manpower, really.
In terms of manpower. And getting a lot of these agencies under control. I think they were not prepared for things like the fact that the government has however many dozens, probably hundreds of Twitter accounts run by all of these people. And sort of getting them in line and getting on message has proven extremely difficult.
Yeah. Hence the freeze. Need some time to figure out what the heck we're doing here, so just stop.
Which I think can seem more malicious than it is in reality. I think to a certain extent we are probably projecting a little bit because we obviously don't like him.
And the word is that the EPA freeze will be lifted possibly as soon as Friday, which is when you guys are watching this.
Yeah.
So it could happen today.
So it's kind of a wait and see thing.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I would say to counter that is I saw the other day, I think it was the Department of Defense Twitter even seemed to be subtweeting Trump.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's...
it was basically tweeting thanks to a Muslim
refugee
soldier. Right. Which seemed, excuse me.
Like we said, woman is dying.
Yeah.
We're all dying.
And yes, I mean, just for the viewers at home, yes, I did just get on the floor to pick up a tissue that I dropped. And yes, I'm about to wipe my nose with it. So just
slow
give
clap.
Me some slack,
slow
okay?
Clap.
We'll point the camera away from you while that happens.
Yeah.
There's been a whole lot of sort of subtweeting the president from a number of the agencies, including the Department of Defense.
But I don't see a gag on the Department of Defense.
Right.
Twitter account.
I'm going to say forget about subtweeting. The Badlands National Park just went full on like YOLO and started tweeting out a whole bunch of climate change facts. I think that was on Friday.
And
I
so
want
the,
to say, or
the,
Monday.
The claim after that was that it was a former employee who still had access to the accounts, which how is that possible?
Yeah.
I think it goes to what Terrence was saying about the lack of preparation and transition there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a... It just seems like a lot of this might just be poorly handling the transition.
And so people are getting in their jabs where they can.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. I'm hesitant to say necessarily that this is, like, the beginning of widespread government censorship. I'm not saying that's not going to happen. But I'm trying to be... a little bit less pessimistic.
That's,
I think
that's generous of you, considering this is the week that the phrase alternative facts
was about to say. I think you have a point, except that when we look at the way that the White House has been treating truth, it doesn't paint a good picture. On its own, perhaps we could just say this is poor transitional stuff, but when you take into account the fact that, facts seem to have no place in the administration to a large degree, yeah.
So I want to come back to that.
I bet you do.
Well, we will. I have some things to say about that. I always have things to say. God, I never shut up, do I?
I mean, that's good energy to have.
Yeah. So before we move on to that, though, yeah. I did want to say the other sort of way of looking at this, the other sort of piece of this, and this is going back to what we were talking about earlier, is Donald Trump kind of sees himself as, and this is a slightly more malicious take, and I think this is also probably somewhat true, which is Donald Trump sees himself as like a wheeler and dealer kind of guy, a negotiator kind of guy. And like one really basic negotiation tactic is to like go out and like ask for the world and then roll it back. So it's really easy to just go out there and go, everybody shut up, no communication with the public. And the moment there's an uproar, well, all right, fine, you can talk to the public. And then everybody goes, oh, see, it's not that bad. He let the Agricultural Research Service talk to the public because that's the one of the agencies that mattered.
Yeah. Before we move on from environmental stuff altogether, I think we also need to mention the Keystone and Dakota Access Pipeline executive order.
Yes.
Which is that those are back on the table for construction. And again, the New York Times kind of said that this was to some extent a symbolic thing more than a major, something that's going to affect major change. But Obama fought to restrict the Keystone XL pipeline in 2015. And you know, now as soon as Trump is in office, he reverses that again. It's broadcasting what his priorities are going to be. Environment low on that list.
By the way, I did have to look up this Department of Defense tweet because I can't remember exactly what it was, and it's still there. It has not been deleted, by the way.
Well, to that point, you're not supposed to delete these tweets from government-owned accounts because they're supposed to be stored under Freedom of Information Act.
So, for those who don't know, this was sent out pretty much at the exact same time that Donald Trump was signing the executive orders around immigration and cutting back on resettling refugees
that
in the United States.
That was yesterday, right?
Yeah.
Or Wednesday, I should say.
As that was being signed, basically, the Department of Defense sent out a tweet that read, from refugee to hashtag Marine, U.S. Marine Corps Corporal Ali J. Muhammad takes the fight to the doorstep of those who cast his family out. Like, that is in, like, pretty directly a spit in the face of the executive order being signed as this was going
out. By the way, if you could use your time machine and go back 20 years to talk to your younger self, how would you explain the sentence, the government is subtweeting itself?
Ooh.
I mean, you wouldn't be able to because tweeting did not exist.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a weird thing to be watching. Like, yeah, I mean, just think about that for a second. The American government is subtweeting.
It's fighting with itself on the internet.
Yeah. It's such a bizarre thing to watch. It's very, very weird. Which, I mean, also, again, makes sense for some of the gag orders. Like, guys, you got to stop this. Like, everybody's got to get on the same page. Right. We have to, like, at least agree on a certain set of, like, decorum and what we can't, like. Look, again,
we're not going to troll ourselves.
Yeah. As much as I clearly have my political differences with, the president, I also think that maybe the Defense Department should not be openly hostile to him on Twitter. Like, that's kind of a bad thing.
There's enough real trouble in the world that we need to deal with, so let's not infight.
Yeah, well, it's not even about infighting. If Donald Trump and his administration are actively trying to suppress information about climate change, if they're trying to suppress data from NASA, leaking that information to journalists is valuable.
Subtweeting is not.
Flippant tweets, while amusing to me as a person, don't necessarily perform that much of a service.
Mm-hmm. Except to make people more annoyed.
Yeah, I mean, which is kind of my issue. It's, you know, again, I appreciate it. It's nice. I get a chuckle out of it. But is it doing some great good? I don't know about that.
It's a stretch.
Yeah.
I do think that the deletion of any of these tweets, though, is really something to pay attention to, because not supposed to do that. And the official POTUS account has already removed several tweets only because of typos, so not a big deal in the grand scheme of things.
Slippery slope.
Yeah, exactly. They're just not supposed to do that.
So,
and they're doing it.
So, here's the thing, is the rules around that aren't necessarily these things need to be updated, to be clear, aren't necessarily that you can't delete them.
Okay.
They just need to be archived someplace.
Gotcha.
So if they delete the tweets, so long as a record of that tweet exists someplace that can be provided under like a Freedom of Information Act request, then that's in compliance with the law.
All right. Once again, try explaining this to ourselves 20 years ago.
But again, this is also why a lot of these rules need to be updated as well. So I don't know.
Do we want to talk about the media sort of mess that you're on to refer to, the restrictions under what people can say? I think you said there was one more thing you really wanted to get into, like sink your teeth into it.
God, I don't even remember at this point. My brain is not working today, apparently.
That happened very suddenly.
It really did.
I mean, I guess we've touched upon the main things here.
So I remember what we were supposed to talk about, which was the alternative facts. So I don't want to dig too much into this.
Yeah.
If I'm honest, I think there's a whole lot to be said there, and a lot of it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with technology or science. So I don't want to go too deep down that rabbit hole. You know, I understand that we are a technology and science website and try to keep it at least somewhat on topic. but the one thing I will say that makes that phrase and sort of the first week of this administration a little bit troubling is how the concept of alternative facts could be levied against things like scientific research, how that would play at the EPA. And I mean, this
yesterday there was that news about how all the EPA stuff has to go through political review first. And again, I think that's another one of those things where it's something that happened under previous administrations, but it's something that's going to be amplified now.
Yeah. So, and I think, you know, and this goes across governmental agencies. It doesn't begin and end with the EPA or NASA or anything like that. There's a lot of ways that that sort of thing could be abused. A lot of it's going to have to come down to, I think, maintaining all of that research available to the public. Like, the public needs to have access to the raw data from the EPA or from NASA. And NASA's always been good about making that available. You can actually go through all of NASA's publicly funded research, I believe. It was actually the story was circulating yesterday again, although the portal is very old for whatever reason. The issue, I think, is going to come from how those facts are interpreted by the administration. And that's
sort of publicly given to the public, like the way that they make these statements.
And I think that's going to be where the biggest problem lies, is in sort of making sure that people understand there is no such thing as alternative facts. There are facts, and then there are lies. And that's kind of the end of the debate.
And if there are alternative facts, where do things like data fit in?
Yeah, like facts and data are the same thing. They are true, no matter how much you don't want to believe them. You can
spin it all you want.
But at the end of the day, the data kind of speaks for itself. And so that's going to be sort of the interesting challenge, I think, for journalists going forward, especially in science and, to a slightly lesser degree in technology, but also there, too.
Well, and for the public digesting this stuff.
Yeah.
Knowing where they should be. Well, the fact that it sounds like the White House press room is like state-run media, basically, because they're going to present us with alternative facts. So you have to know where to go to get the other facts, I guess.
As for Sean Spicer himself, as we were beginning the recording of this podcast, he tweeted out a string of letters and numbers that could have been a password, could have also just been butt tweeting.
Yeah, I'm going to go with butt tweeting because it's not the first time he's done that in the last couple of days. He did it like yesterday, too.
By the time we record our next podcast a week from now, we should know the answer.
I hope so.
But yes.
Clearly it was a password of some kind. And oh, you know what we did not talk? We don't have time to talk about this now. We're going to move on.
What is it? Give us a tease.
I want to talk about the private email
soldiers. Oh my god.
That would have been relevant.
It would have been. I was so focused on the science gag orders and stuff that I forgot about that.
You got excited, I know.
I did. I will say this before we go. It's very early in the stages of planning a scientist march on DC now.
Yes.
As a follow-up, we will be bringing you more information about that as we learn it. It's going to be sort of interesting to see what the turnout for that is like. I mean, obviously, it's not going to be anywhere near the size of the Women's March, but hopefully solid, strong turnout for guys in, you know, white lab coats.
And I hope that their signs are as clever as the ones at the women's marches. They have a big bar to clear there. High bar.
I'm going to go with probably not. There's going to be a lot of bad science puns, and yeah. We all know how much you hate puns.
I hate puns, except
I think
not.
We need to send a reporter down there and just get all the signs.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Twitter's for, I suppose.
Yep.
All right.
Dana, any last thoughts before we call this?
No, I've still got a walloper of a sneeze up there, so I'd rather not do it into the mic.
You can get off the air before you actually get that sneeze out. I'm going to see if I can drag this out long enough so that you actually do it on the air.
Listeners at home, you really don't want to hear my sneeze.
I think they might.
No.
Where can the fine people find you on the internet?
I am Dana Wallman with No Space.
Nate, any final thoughts?
I will say that I went to one of the women's marches this weekend, and it was the lone bright point in a week of hard news. And so support all the people who made that happen, all the organizers, and there's going to be more coming, so that should be good times.
And where can fine people find you?
I'm on the Twitters at Nate Ingram, no space.
I am at Terrence O'Brien, lots of E's, no A's. Please hit us up on Twitter. Let us know what you think, what you want to hear on the show.
Stay out of my mentions, please.
Slide right. into DMs, whatever you got to do.
You can hit me up on Twitter. Leave poor Dana alone. Yeah. Let me know what you think of the show, what you want to hear, what you want to see, all of that stuff. You can also get us podcast@engadget.com or just hit us at Engadget Podcast on Twitter. You know, if you have questions, comments, anything like that, we want to hear it. Make sure to subscribe in your podcast app of choice, rate us on iTunes, all of that stuff. That helps more people find the show, and obviously we want people to listen to the show as much as I said. Maybe you should tune out at the beginning of it. That's clearly bad advice. We do not have a comment of the week for you this week because...
You're all grounded.
Yeah. You would have chosen Aaron on our staff.
Honestly, the best comment we had of the week came from our own employee, and that just felt like cheating. So, thanks for watching, and we will see you next week.
Later.